So, it's interesting. Didn't plan this. Carl, of course, in the Lord's Supper talk, asked the same question, right? Why did Jesus descend and live a human life? And it's interesting how these things sort of just kind of come together, because Carl and I did not plan that. We just happened. Which, it's going to happen fairly often, because this is one of the central themes of the Bible, is Jesus coming to live a human life. That is, yeah, it's probably the central theme, is all that goes around and associated with that. John says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Paul says he was found in human form. And the question is, why? Why did Jesus come and become a human? Divinity becoming flesh, being found in the form of a servant is another place that it says. This idea of Jesus, who was divine, the creator of everything, one who is an authority, one who deserves worship, that sort of a being taking on the form of the created and living a human life. Why? Why did he do that? There are many reasons, which Carl highlighted, several of those reasons, love being, I think, the preeminent one. We see another important reason, a different reason for this, other than his love and the salvation and all those different things that go along with why Jesus did that. We see another one in the Sermon on the Mount, and we are going through the Sermon on the Mount. We are in chapter 5 of Matthew this morning, Matthew 5, 17 through 18. Do not think that I have come, that is, come to earth, become a human. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. These three words here, abolish, fulfill, accomplished. These words all have to do with endings. They all have to do with different kinds of endings, right? To abolish something is to remove it, to get rid of it, to end it, somewhat abruptly, probably, with somewhat destructiveness, to destroy or to put away. That is what this idea of abolishing is. To fulfill is to bring to completion, which is not the same as abolish, and yet it is another kind of ending, that the thing has been full, filled up. When you're filling a cup, you fill the cup, you can't fill it anymore. That's the end of the filling of the cup, because now it is full. This idea of accomplished. And this is a word of purpose, right? Why did Jesus come? To accomplish certain things. And yet even when he would accomplish those things, that would have been an end for his purpose. His purpose would have been accomplished, and therefore there would be no more things left for him to do. All three of these words have to do with endings. And the question, did the old covenant come to an end? Because that's what he's talking about, right? The law and the prophets, two of the three divisions of the Hebrew Old Testament, the law, the prophets, and the writings being the three of them. So he is talking about an ending. Did the old covenant end? Of course it did. Sure it is. Hebrews 8:13, in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, the law and the prophets. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. So when he's talking about this, when he's saying this, it's not that he's saying it's not going to end. And even Jesus himself says it, right? He says, not one jot or iota will pass away from the law until, implying what? That there are some conditions whereby it would indeed pass away. That there are some things that are going to take place, these conditions that are going to be met, by which it would come to an end. So that the question that Jesus is saying, the thing that Jesus is saying is not, I did not come to end the law and the prophets, but it's in how these things were ended. The importance of what Jesus did, one of the reasons why Jesus came, was to end it in a very specific way. Not to abolish, to end before it was accomplished, to bring it to an end prematurely, to destroy, which would be one kind of ending, but to fulfill and accomplish. To bring the law and prophets to their natural conclusion, to satisfy the original purpose that they had. Remember, of course, and this is, we're going to talk about this probably every week. You're going to get sick of me saying it. Jesus did not live under the new covenant. Why? Because the new covenant didn't exist yet, right? It's not going to exist until later. So rather than abolish the law and prophets, he came to fulfill them. During Jesus' time on earth, while Jesus was a human, people were expected to live by the law and the prophets. As a Jewish human male, Jesus was not exempt from the obligations that the law put him under. He was not exempt from the obligations of the law because he was a Jewish human male. And that afforded, or that gave him certain responsibilities toward God. This is part of the complication and part of the complicated part, because wasn't Jesus the original author of that law? So there's some complications going on here. The key to the Sermon on the Mount is understanding the meaning for his audience, the original audience, and then trying to bridge that gap to us. That's what we're trying to do when we understand the Sermon on the Mount. What did Jesus, as he's speaking these things to them, what did that mean for them? And then what does that mean for us? We are trying to figure out what God expects of his people. And one of the things that makes the Sermon on the Mount so iconic, so great, is that it is a sermon that does have a very specific meaning for the people that he was speaking to, and yet it has just as powerful and just as a profound meaning for people of all ages, for Christians into the future. The Sermon on the Mount will be just as applicable for my children and my grandchildren and my great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren 1,000 years from now, if the world lasts that long, as it was for the audience that listened to him speak on that hill. Matthew 5, 17 through 18, this is the one of the sort of interesting intricacies of the text. This idea of not an iota or a dot. What is he saying there? Well, some of you might have different terms there. Iota is the Greek equivalent, of the letter I, which is the smallest letter, just in how much you write it, right? It's just a very small mark. It's a very small letter. This idea of a dot also has a very specific meaning. It's interesting because he brings up the Greek, the Greek letters, and then he brings up the Hebrew letters too. This is the Hebrew alphabet. Yeah, it came out pretty good. And you'll see four dots. Well, why do these dots exist? You'll notice this letter and that letter are identical except for the little dots. That's the only thing that separates them. This letter is identical to that letter except for the little dot. These are the minute, intricate details that separate one letter from another. So what point is Jesus trying to make when he says this? When he says that not an iota, not a dot will pass away from the law until all is accomplished. What is he trying to say here when he says that? Every part of God's law is important. Even the most minute details that separate one commandment from another, even the the smallest intricacies that might separate one circumstance from another circumstance, every part of God's law matters. Can't pick and choose, guys. For the people of his day, the audience that he is speaking to in context, that was the law and the prophets. And yet this principle, this idea, matters just as much for people living under the new law. He expounds upon this in his next point. We keep reading in 19 and 20. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments. Are there commandments that are lesser than others? We'll get into that. Whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Righteousness is an interesting word, an important word here. And as we think about trying to bridge the context, right? Context for them and then for us, meaning for them and then for us. Righteousness does have a universal meaning. A meaning that transcends any particular covenant. Righteousness is that particular quality or that particular behavior which is in accordance with God's will. A righteous person is one who does to the best of their ability that which God desires. For the people of his day, the people that he's speaking to, well, that meant the law and the prophets. That was the thing that God desired for those people. To live according to the law and the prophets, the things that were written down for them, to carry that out to the best of their ability, which the Pharisees were not. We'll get into that. For us, unless our righteousness exceeds the scribes and the Pharisees, what does that mean? Unless we are living to the best of our ability, the way that God has desired for us to live today, which he spells out for us in Acts through Revelation. That's what Acts through Revelation is. What does God expect of his people living today? He sets up the Pharisees as a negative example of what he's trying to teach, a negative example of what righteousness should not be, of how we should not be interacting with God's law. What were they doing wrong? What were the Pharisees doing that was so unrighteous? How were they lacking in righteousness? Matthew 23, 1 through 4, Jesus said to the crowd and to his disciples, "The scribes and Pharisees, they sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you, but do not do the works that they do. For they preach, but they do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger." What is he saying? Part of the Pharisees' unrighteousness was hypocrisy. Teaching the law of God, which again for them was the commandments we find in Exodus through Deuteronomy, all of the different warnings of the prophets. Why does he group the law and the prophets together? Because the prophets contained so many warnings about what God expected for his people, behavior that God wanted his people to have. And the Pharisees, they were teaching those things. They were expounding upon those things in the writings. But they were not doing it themselves. How will your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees? You will do the things that you teach. Right? You will be consistent. You will not be telling others you need to treat your wife well and then go home and abuse her mentally or physically. You will not tell others that righteousness and God's people are your highest priority and then miss every opportunity you have to spend with God's people. You will not tell others, don't lie, cheat, steal, and then go lie, cheat, and steal. Your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Matthew 23, 23 and 24. Matthew 23 is a big passage for this. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites," there's that word again, "for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law." Remember, we asked that question. Are some commandments less than others? Whoever relaxes the least of these commandments? And Jesus does say, right, that some matters are weightier. They carry more weight. They are heavier. Justice and mercy and faithfulness. Indeed, there does seem to be this idea that some of the commandments have more weight to them. The more, I don't know, maybe they're more difficult to carry out. Maybe they have more practical bearing. Maybe they have more results in our relationships, whatever it is. And yet, what does Jesus say? These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Doesn't this go back to the same point? Not an iota or a jot. You think about those little dots on the Hebrew letters there. It is the smallest part of the Hebrew letter. It's just a little point, a little dot. And yet without those smallest part, without that smallest thing, some of the letters look identical. You would not be able to tell one letter apart from the other unless that little tiny piece was there. What is he saying here? You ought to have done it all. You need to do all of what God expects of his people. And for them, of course, in the Pharisees, the scribes and the Pharisees, he gives a specific example, the idea of the tithing of the mint and the cumin and so on and so forth. And wasn't this one of the things that the prophets said over and over and over? You're making your sacrifices. You're offering this worship to me. And yet I detest your worship. I do not want to see your worship. I will not accept your sacrifices. Why? Because you're oppressing each other and you're mistreating the poor. And there is no justice in your cities. Can't pick and choose what you want to do of God's law. They were doing exactly what Jesus said not to do. And in fact, they were kind of doing even worse than what Jesus said not to do, right? It's not that they were relaxing the least of these commandments. They were relaxing the greatest of these commandments. Mark 7, 9 through 13. He said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. That's in the commandments, right? But you say, if a man tells his father or mother, whatever you have gained from me is Corban, that is given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making the word of God void by your tradition that you have handed down. As if that were not bad enough, and many such things you do. Not just in this one particular instance, but you guys do this a lot. What is he saying here? This idea of Corban, you give it to God. Is it good to give money to God? Is it good to give money to God? I hope so, because we just all did it. Okay, so I hope it's good. And yet, what does he say? There is another commandment, honor your father and mother. Which, in this context, Jesus is saying that had a monetary component, a physical component to that, that you would support and help financially, physically, your parents. That was the idea. That was what God wanted. And the Pharisees had turned that around and said, okay, well, there's this money that I would give to my father and mother so they could have a house and eat and stuff like that. But I'm going to take that money and I'm going to give it to the temple. It's going to be Corban. Which, on the surface, seems fine. We're giving money to God. And yet, what does he say? You are making the word of God void. You're misunderstanding what I said. You're misunderstanding the point of the commandment. What was the point of the commandment? That the father and the mother would have what they need. And by this tradition, this interpretation of the law, they had made that commandment of no effect because the father and mother were not getting what they needed. We're seeing examples here of what he says. They were making their religion about themselves instead of the things that God had actually said. Don't we do that today? We want to make our religion about what I want, this interpretation that suits me, instead of about what God actually wanted. We keep going. We've asked two questions. Why did Jesus come to earth? Number one. How do we apply the Sermon on the Mount to ourselves? Number two. Both of these questions have been and are answered in this section of the text, Matthew 5, 16 through 20. Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Jesus, in his life and his teaching, both of these, teaching and life, shows us what it meant to follow the old law the way God intended it. Over the millennia that Israel was worshiping and having this relationship with God, what God had originally intended had gotten lost somehow. They had twisted it, made it about themselves. And that's what the prophets, why does he bring the prophets into this, right? The law was the original commandments, the instructions that Moses had handed down to the Israelites. And the prophets were the ones who had warned them over and over again, you guys are not living the way the law requires. You guys are missing the point of the law. And the prophets over and over said, you need to change your behavior. You need to change your behavior. So he lumps these two things in together, the law and the prophets. The law, the original commandments, the prophets sort of warning them not to misinterpret things. Jesus in his life shows us what it means to be truly righteous, to live according to the standard of God's law. For us, that law is different, but the principle is the same. Jesus shows us what it means to live the way that God intended us to live. This idea of the word fulfilled, for the thing to be full and complete. They had been missing the point, and Jesus showed them clearly, not just in his teaching, but by the things that he did. We see a couple important lessons for ourselves in this. Number one, I hope this has become abundantly clear. You cannot pick and choose from God's law. Now, I'm not picking and choosing from the old law, because Hebrews 8, what does that say? It's obsolete, vanishing away. I don't need to worry about the old law. But are there some laws in the New Testament? Are there laws in the New Testament? Yeah, there are. There are a lot of them. It's not a nice list like in Exodus. Exodus was nice because it was just a handy list that I could just write down. The New Testament's not like that. And yet there are definitely standards of behavior that God has for his people. definitely instructions and commandments that the apostles have laid down that this is how you need to live. And you can't just pick and choose what you want. You can't just say, I'm going to do this thing over here that Paul says in Philippians. And then over here, this thing that Paul says in Galatians, I don't really want to do that. Not an iota, the smallest letter of the Greek alphabet, just a little tick mark. Not a dot, the smallest part of the Hebrew alphabet, just a little point that separates one letter from another. Not an iota or a dot can be excluded from God's law. You cannot pick and choose. God's covenants, having a relationship with God, is an all or nothing proposition. Can't just pick and choose what you want. Number two, practice what you preach. And this is a particularly powerful warning, right? For the scribes and the Pharisees, the teachers of the law. If you say that people need to live a certain way, then live that way yourself. Steve talked about this in the parenting class, right? We have certain standards of behavior for our children. We expect our children to treat people a certain way, but then they turn around and look at us and we don't treat people that way. How are our children going to learn if I'm not doing the thing that I say my children need to do? But it's the same for evangelism, right? We're teaching people about God's law. We're trying to teach people about what it means to be a Christian. We're trying to be the salt and the light, like you said last week. And yet, if we're not living the way that we're preaching, if we're not living the things that we teach, are we the salt and the light? Our salt has become flavorless, and our lamp has just been covered up because we will not live the way that we teach. Matthew 5:20, the conclusion of the matter. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. This applies to the people of his day, the people that were sitting on the mountain listening to him, and this applies to you and me as well. Not that I need to do the things of the old law like the scribes and the Pharisees did, but let's reiterate this. I need to live to the best of my ability, live out the commandments that God has for me. They are different commandments, but I need to do them to the best of my ability, not be a hypocrite, not pick and choose, not expect others to do things that I won't do, and definitely not put my traditions above those commandments. The Sermon on the Mount is a lesson in what true righteousness looks like. And we're going to see that in chapter 6. We're going to see that in chapter 7. These different instructions that Jesus has about true righteousness. The concluding question is this. We use this term modern day Pharisee. I don't know if we use it, but I see it in writings all the time. I see it in different blog posts, and I see it in academic journals, and I see it all over the place. The idea of modern day Pharisees. We really do need to ask ourselves that, because what Jesus says is important. Your righteousness must be greater than the scribes and the Pharisees. Are you a modern-day Pharisee? Are you doing the same sorts of things that the Pharisees did in treating God's law as secondary, in putting their own traditions first, in refusing to do what they preach? That's going to require some self-examination. And what does Jesus warn? If you're not exceeding them, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. You just won't. You're not in it now, and you never will be. Are you a modern-day Pharisee? And the question we might ask for ourselves, do you see this behavior in us? And if you do, man, please let us know. Because if we're doing this sort of stuff, I need to know so we can fix it. We need to change. We need to be living according to the righteousness that God has laid forth for his people.